Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you. Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you today, Robert?
Today, Russell, I am feeling like a wordsmith.
Oh, okay.
And not just any old wordsmith. I'm talking about an iconic, groundbreaking, trailblazing wordsmith.
Wow.
Someone who has genuinely impacted the way that I see and feel about art because of the language that she uses. And yesterday we met the wonderful Taboo, and I actually brought up this topic of the word chimeric, which I didn't even know as a word because
yes,
I'm very ignorant. And I loved that just that selection of that single word, and it really got me thinking. It kind of summed up that skill and precision that you have to have as a writer. And today's guest has been working for many decades now and started out in like the galleries such as Paula Cooper Gallery, like helping out, and wrote for Art Forum and Art in America and Village Voice and all of these very seminal, important magazines and areas of criticism. And I'm really excited to talk about all of the different types of writing you do when you work in different magazines as well, because each of those publications has very specific approach. And I think sometimes when you think about a critic, that people don't always understand the kind of artistry behind that.
Yes.
And today's guest is currently the co-chief art critic of the New York Times and is the first woman to ever have that position. And, you know, has really opened up so much for all of us. Even in solidarity with like the queer community, I feel like you've supported so many queer artists as well as women in art. And when you think of like people like our friend Katie Hessel, I think you've really created a blueprint that so many younger people are inspired by. So we are here in gratitude and in deep respect for the one and only guest that we have here today. So we would like to welcome to Talk Art, Roberta Smith. Hi, Roberta.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here. I've thought about being able to do this with you guys for a long time. So.
That's a very generous thought to have. why would that be? Why would you want to talk to us? Because we're so in awe of you and we know your work so well.
Well, you've been so totally, you know, you've done so many people and they've been so interesting, and you did my husband. So that immediately locked you into ultimately ending up with me.
Well, thank you for inviting us into your apartment in New York. This is incredible to come in here and see how an art critic lives, and they live with a lot of books and they live with a lot of art.
That's true.
Books are surrounding us, and that makes complete sense. How important are books to you?
Well, not every book in here is equally important, but what we have is the ability to kind of research anything. So if I'm doing an obit or on an artist, we usually have catalogs of that artist's work. If I'm writing about a certain period of art, we tend to represent it. I have what I would call a fantastic deck arts library, you know, because I'm really interested in ceramics and weaving and ceramics. And then the way those transcend the division of craft and art. And in some places, they are the art because you don't have tremendous number of artists painting or at any artist painting.
Yeah, yeah. So. Do you prefer working from a book if you're doing research, say, than going on the internet? Do you find that if you had the...
Oh, yeah, I forgot the internet. I always forget the internet. Well, obviously, an internet is easier. So, that's very accessible, but at the Times, we can't take anything from Wiki. So that cuts out a big...
That's just the rule.
There's just like an institutional mistrust of Wiki.
Okay.
So... They say, where did that come from? I said, oh, I got it from Wiki. And they say, nope. You have to verify it somewhere else.
So what do you trust then? Where would you look for your, if you were doing research on someone, if you didn't have the book for them?
Well, I don't know. I think we have books for everything. But, you know, you get a lot of information. Say it's a museum show, you get a fair amount of information. But I'm doing the Fauvism show at the Met, and I've got a couple of books, including a book of a big show of Fauvism that the Met did 33 years ago that I actually reviewed, which is kind of embarrassing. All I can remember about reviewing the show is being terrified because it was a huge show. Anyway, so I have that catalog, and I have a couple of other things. And
then I find that really interesting that you're terrified. You, Roberta Smith, would be terrified. Do you still feel that today when you review shows?
Oh, yeah.
You do?
Yeah.
Because of feeling like, what, you don't know enough, or?
Well, yeah. I mean, I only have a BA. I never went to graduate school. So everything I know, I kind of learned on the job, you know, like speed reading catalogs or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I love this quote from Peter Sheldahl, who said that sometimes when you write a review, it has everything you know about the subject in it. In other words, everything you've just learned, so that you can kind of cobble together a credible review. And the main thing is you don't act like you know it all. You know, that you're familiar with it, or.
But that must be a skill, not to come across as kind of almost obnoxious in your intelligence when it comes to art. That is definitely a skill that you have, where you feel like you connect to so many people, even though you're writing about something that a lot of people wouldn't really understand or get to see themselves.
Well, you have to keep in mind what your audience is. Mm. And I've been, you know, at times that they'll say, you know, this isn't, the common reader is not going to get through this, you know, rewrite this sentence or rewrite this graph. But I do pretty well. I mean, I've always been very dedicated to kind of plain language, you know. And, you know, it's really great if you're writing something. Like the thing that I do is that I take exhibitions as a kind of object, as a kind of place. And my review is supposed to lead people through it and sort of give them ideas about how to look at it and where to pick out certain objects. So that's already a kind of manageable unit in my head. Mm. You know, and I can put in a historical background, so I can just say, you know, look at this, and now go look at that and see how they relate, you know, something like that. But, and I'm sort of the same way with my writing. I mean, at a certain point, I realized, like when I was overwriting, the reader never knows what you had to leave out. No. Do you know? That what you want is a kind of wholeness. And I also proceed sort of spatially, because at a certain point, at different points, I'll say, what does the reader need to know now? So I'm really just a reviewer. I don't really think I'm a critic in the high-blown sense.
Well, I love the fact that you're thinking of the reader rather than the artist that you're reviewing. At no point are you going, speaking for you, but it feels like the reader is, and that the audience is the most important person, rather than actually connecting to the artist, say, and hoping that they will appreciate what you're saying, or they will be. Do you feel a responsibility to the artist or more the audience?
Well, I try not to talk to artists. You know, I've always said this, it's repeated, artists don't own the meaning of their work. You know, nobody who makes art can think about it in a holistic way, think about it in a full 360. It's just not possible. And I'm thrilled when artists like my writing, but I'm not writing for them. I'm writing for people who are trying to figure out how to look at the work and who are going to start with my opinion and sort of understand how you form an opinion, which is by looking and by interrogating your subjective responses. You know, so I wouldn't presume that I could teach an artist anything about their work, but occasionally I have. So that's sort of the icing on the cake.
That's a generous gift, but did you ever think that artists, when you first started out, were able to look at themselves from a kind of...
No, I mean, I started out in completely a different position. You know, I really... some of my first articles were on individual artists like Gustav and Archfager. There might have been one other, Scott Burton. And I would go to them and talk to them, particularly Gustum. And it was incredibly important to me that they liked the artist. When I went to The Voice, from Art in America to The Voice, that completely...
This is The Village Voice.
Yeah. That was completely transformed, because what happened was my writing was in print while the art people that it was about was on the wall or in the gallery. So people could take a review and go and really check about what I said against the actual thing. And that kind of forced...
And that was a new concept, because the thing is, that sort of makes complete sense that you'd want to read a review and see the show.
Yeah.
So often we read reviews when the show's been long closed.
Well, that's
and
we're
the same with the podcast. We try and get, if someone's got a show on, we want the podcast out. So we're like you're a guide. We want to be a guide. So we're saying to people, this is how you see the work. It feels like obvious, but when it isn't, it doesn't make sense that you would review something months after it's been on.
Well, that's the physical limitations, though. Print before the internet, before digital printing, they were by definition about six weeks late, if not later. And
that's crazy. It just
doesn't. I know it is.
And that's still the case now for certain publications.
It sort of
is,
but they all have an online component,
okay.
And so they're putting out little reviews. But no, it was a huge difference, and it was like a kind of truth serum, like. You know, there's nothing you can do but be honest, and you're not there to kind of be honest about what the artist said. You're supposed to be honest about what you said. And that was a big turnaround. I mean, literally, what is it, half is 180? It was like I went from being sort of a spokesperson for the artist to being a representative of the audience. And sort of being on the front row and going in and say, okay, this is what you can see here. This is what I think. And artists had nothing to do with it.
Did you upset a few artists at that? So you were the spokesperson for them. You're on their side, say, and suddenly you're there. Would they see you as... Did they see the critic as the enemy in some capacity?
I wasn't that well known when I went to The Voice. So I don't know. And I didn't talk to people, but I know that I made some people very unhappy.
Did you?
You know, for a while, I had people who didn't speak to me.
Like who, can you say?
No.
But did that upset you that you'd upset them, or was you kind of very staunch in what your opinion was and that was what it was?
Both.
Right.
I mean, you write what you want to write, and then you realize, hey, this is going to go into print. And that would be terrifying. So... You know, you had to get over that. Like I used to kind of go into a fetal position. I would whimper, and Jerry said, "What is it?" I said, "It's Thursday night." And he said, "Oh yeah, you're in print tomorrow." You know, so it was.
And how would they? Were the artists? Sorry, I'm not letting you talk.
No, he's not.
But are you? Were the artists like? Sorry, Rob, but were the artists like call you up and go, "What the fuck are you doing? How could you say this about me? How would you know that they were upset?"
Well. They wouldn't speak to you when you saw them again, you know, if you've been sort of an acquaintance.
Oh, my God.
So, but that, you know.
So you lost friendships sometimes over it.
Yeah. I mean, and at a certain point, you realize you have to kind of absent yourself. Like I don't want to know artists right now, because if I get to know them too well, I won't write about them. You know, I don't write about Tip's work, for example.
This is Carol Dunham's work, who you live with. There's a few pieces here.
Yeah. Because he's a really good friend of mine. And
so you would have to turn down a review if something.
Yeah, because it like clouds your judgment, yeah.
But if like the New York Times said, we need one, Carol Dunham, he's got this big retrospective or something, you would say, I can't do it.
No, it's totally, I've said it. These are the artists I don't write about.
Who else?
Well, Terry Winters, who I used to live with.
Right.
And Laurie Simmons. And there are a few others. I don't know, it just wouldn't feel right. Maybe once I leave the Times, there'll be this, I'll be writing about these people. I don't know.
Oh.
You know, but there's a kind of code of ethics at the paper, and they expect you to kind of define it for your own discipline. And I don't know. I mean, I think John Russell used to write about people he was friendly with. And you know who John Russell is?
I've heard of him. So he wrote for?
He wrote for The Times.
Right.
He actually brought me to The Times.
Oh, wow.
So he was... close to retirement when he did that.
And did he give you advice when you started? Was he like, don't write about your friends? Well, even though he did, or?
No, nobody gave me advice. really, they just like kick you off the deep end. And if you rise to the surface again, they give you another assignment, you know? Criticism is a very weird activity. I mean, I don't think it, I think critics can teach it, but if you're teaching it and you've never been a critic, and I have, I guess, when I say I don't consider myself a critic, I do, but I have a kind of, you know, in the hierarchy of critics, I'm sort of along the bottom. I mean, I am a reviewer. There's nothing I like more than going to a gallery, seeing a show I really want to write about and doing it and conveying either my excitement or my outrage or whatever. And I don't write essays, you know, I'm very aware of that. And I don't, at this point, I'm not collecting my writing. I don't really see that as a...
What do you mean, not collecting
it? I'm not collecting my reviews into a book and having them brought out as a physical book.
Have you been approached to do that?
Well, there have been people who would help me edit it, which is a huge, huge task.
Yes.
But no one has.
Well, so, after this, maybe Roberta,
so
after
it's
this.
It's pretty easy. No, but it's just, first of all, it's time consuming. Secondly, it means you have to go back and read stuff, which I almost never do.
Once it's out there, it's gone. Yeah. You forget about it.
That's the thing about, particularly about writing for a paper that's, well, a daily, but even for a weekly, you just have to keep going. You just, it's such a great thing pushing you toward
the future. It's a momentum you can't get off.
Yeah, don't right. Look back.
Okay, this week you wrote about, say, Munch, and you really learned quite a bit about Munch. You got a few Munch books together, you read catalog essays, you read online, blah, blah, blah. And then next week it's somebody else. And the thing is that a lot of what I learned about Munch is then gone.
Yeah.
You know,
wipe
it's then,
the hard drive.
It erased, yeah. It's erased by the next thing. And sooner or later, some of you start retaining it and it starts building up. But there's this, you know, you just have finished writing and you think, my God, I probably know more about this show than anyone. Because I've looked at it 3 or 4 times and I've gone over it work by work and label by label. And not everybody has to do this kind of, some people just go in and look. I mean, Peter used to just go in and sort of look at a show and then he had all these ideas about the artists and the art. I'm not sure I have real ideas, do you know? I'm really interested in what I get from the object and what's available for other viewers to get from the object.
That's what's always struck me about your writing, though, is I feel like, A, it's short form, so it's very concise, and you were talking about that very sort of plain language you need, but often you bring out very rich textures through your choice of language. And it really strikes me, it must be, I would find that really stressful, like this idea of having to be really concise. Like I'm actually more of a free flower writer. I can write pages and pages and pages and not, you know, when you have to like reduce
or edit
and get to the pure kind of thought or the meaning behind it. And there's something in your short form that I think is looking at the work, which other writers often don't actually do. Like, they're obviously looking at the work, but I mean, there's some sort of like feeling towards
instinct.
The object, like you're talking about. Yeah. Do you think that is unique to the way you write?
I don't know if it's unique. I don't write that. I don't read, particularly now with Peter gone, I don't read that many other people. But I think it might be a little bit, particularly right now when we've had so much contextualization in terms of the art object and in history and in contemporary looking. Which is always interesting, but it's just not, you know, it's not what I wanted to do. And consequently, it's also not what I was educated to do. You know, I don't keep up with reading. I keep up with art and look at what people are doing. And then you can kind of extrapolate. Like conceptual art really forced me to write a different way, to write more about narrative, to write more about ideas. And I welcome that. But it's mostly the art that sort of guides you a bit.
So conceptual art was quite a big shift for you in the way you thought about how to write.
Well, the first artist I ever knew and was sort of learned from was Donald Judd, who didn't have much patience for conceptual art.
And because he was a minimalist artist.
Because he said, art is something you look at. And that was... And I agree with that. And in some way, I ultimately still agree with it. But I do think there are different kinds of visuality. And I do think that really good conceptual art is involved with form, which is something, the discussion of which is, can be very minimal these days. Yeah, there wasn't an object that wasn't there just by necessity, do you know?
There's a quote you said, when it comes to your taste, you're very orientated towards things that don't move.
Yeah, I am.
Which makes complete sense with Donald Judd in some capacity, because they are structures, they are solid.
Right.
They're in the room, they're not ideas based. They're very much like they are an idea originally and then they are created.
Right.
So do you think your taste has been defined by these friendships and relationships that you've built up with artists over the years?
Well, you know, I was still in college when I knew Judd, and I had no idea that I would be a critic, although I did read all of his writing, which was very foundational for me. I mean, and at that point, there wasn't that much writing. He wrote a lot more, starting in the late 60s, which is when I first met him. But yeah, I mean, after I worked for Judd, I worked for Paula Cooper, which was a completely different aesthetic. You know, those artists were kind of the artists that were left out of conceptual art, you know, like Joel Shapiro, Jennifer Bartlett, Elizabeth Murray, John Borofsky, Alan Shields. They were all, Joel Fisher. They were all more object and material oriented. Yeah. And I remember when I left Paul's, I worked there for 2.5 years. And when I left it, this kind of major conceptual artist came up to me and said, "I'm so glad you left this gallery. Now we can talk to you." I'm sure it was a joke. I'm sure it was meant lightheartedly.
Yeah.
But, you know, there was a split. Like Paula Cooper was one side and Sonnabend was sort of the
other.
It's
a bit West Side Story of the art world.
Yeah, exactly.
I think it's still like that, though. I think each gallery can become its own universe in a way.
Or the galleries they move around within packs, don't they?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And also you're competing, I guess, for an audience or for sales or for whatever it is. So I guess there's always this kind of individual camps.
Well, I mean, art dealers are, you know, I'd love to read a psychoanalysis kind of general one of what it takes to be an art dealer. Because I think they're the most important people in a way, that they're the ones that help art get out of the studio, get into view. And I do think that they partly do that by creating their own worlds from scratch. And you don't see a lot of art dealers in other art dealers' galleries.
No.
You know, they really, that's in their gallery is where they want to be. And I don't know what they feel when they, like if somebody's really important, you know, like Richter or somebody, you'll see an art dealer, see people sort of slinking around looking. But I don't know what it's like. It's like going to another artist's studio for an art dealer, which is fine, but you may not be psychically experienced at doing that.
Yeah, maybe it would be a distraction or something from your own
path. Well, they sit in their galleries and the entire art world comes to them.
Yeah.
There's nobody who doesn't pass through those doors, which is why it's so interesting, because you can really see how it works. And it always has fascinated me that quite a few art dealers, at least younger art dealers, were originally artists. And they veer off. They start working like in the back of the gallery, either making crates or, you know, keeping records or doing whatever. And then they kind of gradually start coming into the whole activity. And, you know, like Gavin Brown is the prime example. It goes from being an artist to being a really great dealer.
And I didn't realize Gavin Brown was an artist.
Yeah.
Was he good, Roberta Smith, in your opinion?
I don't remember.
Did you see his art?
You don't remember.
I get to say that more and more now.
I don't remember. That's your way out.
There's so much I don't remember.
It's a very good excuse.
I would like to psychoanalyze collectors as well. You're saying about art dealers. I think a collector's brain is very unique.
But that's been done more. There are a couple of books about it. I forget the title.
But a Freudian approach to it or a Jung approach to it, what that all is. But do you, when you write, is a collector on your mind ever?
Well, not in the explicit sense, but there is art that I write about that I would like to own, but I don't, and probably won't.
Because of ethics.
Because of ethics, yeah. It just gets too. I mean, all of the art here either is Jerry's or came in before I started to write for the Times. Some of them were gifts from non-artists, not from the artists.
You're happy to take a gift?
Well, from a friend.
Yeah.
You know, so.
But also you have.
A bribe.
When we interviewed Jerry, he spoke about a few works you have here that are copies.
Right.
So they're kind of fakes and they're
bootlegs.
And they're explicitly like represented
we
as that. They're
not those.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. And the one that you like the most is that weeping woman.
I know. I just love that painting. It has everything in it.
Picasso, yeah.
Yeah. And the Tate owns it.
Oh, the Tate owns that one.
Yeah.
Ah.
You don't know that?
No, I know. I've seen it in London. I didn't know they owned it, actually. I've also seen it in Paris because there was a show.
Oh, it's
maybe...
probably. It's in a lot of shows. It was...
She's toured around crying all over the world.
And I've seen it in Madrid, actually. Yeah.
Roland Penrose was visiting Picasso the day, at least this is the story, the day he painted that. And he asked for it. And Picasso gave it to him. And then he gave it to the Tate.
Right.
Who's Roland Penrose?
He's British. He's an artist and a writer. So he hung around with artists a whole lot. But listen, I know him primarily because of Lee Miller, who was his wife. And I've seen a few of his paintings, but I know him mostly because of that. I just think that took such balls.
I'll have that. Thank you. Yeah.
If we go all the way back, I know you were born in New York City, but you grew up in Kansas. And I met a collector the other night and we spent literally 40 minutes talking about Kansas and about how there wasn't much there, is what he said, and a lot of nature. And it got me thinking about this blankness somehow. Sometimes when there are places that are quite open, either concrete, where it's, you know, I remember there's David Bowie stories of places he would go to, or like Detroit back in the 70s, mm-hmm. Or Berlin in that kind of 80s era, where there's a lot of space psychologically for people to become these kind of big characters or even writers. You know, some of my favorite writers ever have come from very remote places and maybe never even left those places, but just wrote all of their lives, these kind of like dreams of other worlds. How important was Kansas to you, like forming the writer that you sort of became? Do you think it had an impact on you?
Well, I was sort of clinging to the eastern edge of Kansas, sort of right outside of Kansas City, and it wasn't empty there.
Oh,
I mean,
okay.
Some of it was, but I couldn't answer that question. I don't know how I became a writer. I was told I was a good writer before I became a critic. I mean, in college and in high school, I wrote very easily. And my father, my grandfather, were both writers of a sort. They were academics. But Kansas was good probably for me because it was empty in another sense. There weren't, when I come here, I can't imagine people growing up here because there's so much you can do. And then your peers are doing so much that, you know, it's hard not to feel competitive or whatever. I mean, people who've grown up here, I'm so amazed by what they know, their style sense, all this stuff, how early they were doing things like there was a shoe, there were Papagallo shoes when I was growing up. Well, friends here had them too, but they had them like 3 or 4 grades earlier than I did. You know, they would make their way out to Kansas. And I think that there was that kind of... I think lack of competition is good for me, unfortunately. But there was that kind of emptiness.
Was there a museum in Kansas? Is there a museum?
Oh, yeah. Well, there's the Nelson Atkins in Kansas City, which is a great museum, particularly in Asian art, because one director was there right after World War II, sort of getting a lot of things, a man named Lawrence Sickman. And then there was a university museum. I grew up at the University of Kansas,
right,
in a town called named Lawrence, Kansas,
uh-huh,
which is where Quantrill's Raid was.
Where what?
Quantrill's Raid.
What's that?
It was like a bunch of cowboys coming into town and setting things on fire. And I think it was it was called Bleeding Kansas because it was in the years just before the Civil War, there was a lot of contention and a lot of fighting about which new states were going to be, if new states were going to be slave states. And Kansas didn't turn out to be that way, but there were
a proportion of people that wanted it to be.
Well, but there were also, I guess Cointreau is a kind of guerrilla, you know, coming in and right. trying to make an impression.
Scaring people.
Yeah, yeah. But, if you're in a university town in a place like Kansas, you're very much in a bubble. Yeah. You know, the rest of the state thinks you're communists and you're this little town that votes blue. So in that way, you're very protected because you may not know them, but there are people from all over the world there. You know, it's sort of fairly international.
And why did you end up in New York? And why do you think New York has been historically such an epicenter for art?
Well, I ended up with New York because I was going to school in Iowa and I had a kind of New Yorker manqué for a teacher who kept up on everything that happened in New York. And he found out about this thing called the Whitney Independent Study Program, which had existed for like one semester. And he just said to me, you are applying for this. And I said, me? I said, if I get in, do I have to go? And he said, definitely. And I got in. And partly because I proposed doing a paper on Judd. That was your main application. Artists went on their, applying with their work. And non-artists, art historians, applied with a topic. And, the first day I got here was like, oh, my God. I mean, I'd been here a couple of times as a kid, but it hadn't really hit me. But I just loved it immediately so much. And it really, I say this probably too often, but the first thing, one of the things that came to my mind was I could be happy here, which I don't think I'd quite grasped that was a possibility in my life,
And you have been happy here.
Yeah.
And at no point you've ever thought, Jerry, come on, we need to go LA, we need to go Paris, Rome, London, we need to do our jobs there.
Cities that have really great public transportation systems, mostly London and Paris, have a certain appeal. Mm. But no, not really. He's the one who wants to go. He like had to work through his whole desire to be in LA. And now that's over. And he likes to be up in the country with nature.
And we spoke about that the other night at dinner. We were sitting next to each other at Tracy Emin's dinner. And it really made me laugh because I said, you must really enjoy being upstate or in Connecticut or, wherever you spent the pandemic. But your response was, I wanted to get back to the city. I love being in the city.
I mean, I love being up there for specific lengths of time, and then coming back. But I think I might end up living up there. And I'm hoping that when that happens, by that time, I will have gotten old and frail enough that I want to be up there. But on the other hand, I think this neighborhood in particular, it's like half NYU student and half elders, So there are a lot of people who are older than me, who are still living their lives here and doing quite well.
But also something tells me you'll miss going to all the brand new exhibitions and seeing all the new art.
I want to stay here with them.
Yeah, exactly.
How often do you write? How often are you having to write a critical response to
your show? Well, I used to write once a week, but now it's more like every other week. I'm kind of slowing down a little. And the other thing that's a little upsetting is that it's taking me longer to write. And I read something recently. Some writer said, writing doesn't get any easier. It's not something you can look forward to, which really gave me heart.
Do you pitch the shows that you want to write about, or they approach you and say, this is coming up, can you cover this, Roberta?
Both.
Okay.
And then there's a kind of, the gallery situation is kind of a, first come, first serve. We have a kind of rotating list on that you can contribute to online. And once you've done that, you're going to review that show unless there's some kind of conflict, like an editor has asked somebody else to do that review.
And you're co-chief. So right. You're with another...
Holland Cotter is the other co-chief.
Are you rivals or friends?
I would say neither.
What?
Well,
what's that then, if you're not a rival or a friend?
Neutral.
It's kind of neutral. I mean, I love Holland in a certain way, and I think he loves me. we're not actually that compatible, do you know?
But not competitive either.
I think we've worked through that.
But you were. There was competition when it all started.
Well, but we're not going to talk about that.
That's fine, of course. Yeah, no.
It's almost like two circles and you're both covering different things maybe. You know what I mean? Like, and
well,
then maybe
Colin
you meet
has
in
a
the
very
middle.
Specific.
Exactly, yeah.
We're talking about circles and the cyclical nature. Derek Jarman said, if you wait long enough, the world moves in circles. When it comes to art, you must see trends or the same sort of movements coming around because you've been doing it for decades now, where you go, that artwork then was fresh and now it's back here 30 years later and everybody's going, wow, what's this? And you're like, hang on, guys, slow down. I saw this 30 years ago. Do you find that art, the art world, the nature of artists is cyclical?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, when I came into the art world, you know, figurative art was just, you know, very marginalized. Everything was abstract. And it was sort of as if, well, it's going to stay this way. And it didn't. So that was, you know, that was fascinating to see how people who were marginalized at a certain point are celebrated at another point. And so that circling goes on in many ways, that things, the art world does circle back for things that were sort of left out, and there's this whole retrieval process. But there's also this repetitive thing where, and at a certain point you just say, well, what am I gonna do? Like go and say, so-and-so, an artist, this younger artist has probably never heard of, did this 30 years ago. I mean,
but can't be you, do you not have a responsibility to say that?
I know it's not something that I say a lot. And also when something strikes me that way, it's probably not something I'll write about. You know, because I know I haven't much good to say about it. And it's just somebody's first show or second show, you know. So
you want to be kind.
Yeah. I mean, like right now, my kind of writing is not in fashion. I'm very aware of that, that people write from a much broader, more contextualizing points of view. So I'm hoping that, you know, it'll be cyclical enough to maybe pick me up again, you know?
Yeah. Is there anything new when it comes to art? Do you ever go, okay, I have never seen anything like this? Or do you feel like you've probably seen most versions of something, even if it's an extended version or a different idea within the same context?
Well, things, you know, art's always using fragments of other art. So you've seen parts of things, but it's usually put together differently. And I do think that humans are hardwired to experience the new, to have the new. You know, like, we don't listen to derivatives of Beatles songs forever. Somebody will say, well, a lot of art is a derivative of a Beatles song. And yeah, there's always going to be stuff like that, but something that's really new makes an impact.
Are you aware of, or hyper aware of trends? Are these things that you sort of try and avoid? Or if like an artist is deemed as hot and there's like a group of artists that are all sort of doing the same thing, do you run towards that or are you slightly back foot on that?
If it's early enough, I might go toward it. But if it's already been there a while, I probably wouldn't. But, you know, you look for things that will have a certain amount of impact. So if writing about an artist who's sort of right in the center, you know, there's a certain, that's attractive.
Exactly.
You have an audience for the review. I mean, and I don't mind doing that. And I just, by the same measure, I like writing from the edges. I mean, I think that's my main contribution, is that I've written about outsider art and ceramics as art. And I think I did that, you know, when there weren't a lot of people doing it. And Jerry, too, at least in terms of outsider art. So,
do you write outside of critical theory for pleasure? Do you ever write like...
Well, first of all, I don't write inside critical theory. At least I don't think. And I write letters. That's how I started writing. And I start writing letters and they just could go on forever. So I don't do that too much.
Yeah,
but that's really my first writing. was writing my parents about college or living in New York. I don't do a lot of out, but it's still, there's a kind of way I write emails where I know, oh, you're writing. You know, you're like going over and changing words and doing all this stuff and saying something in a slightly peculiar way, a way that I know comes from the way my father talked and certain little colloquialisms that we had around the house. My father had a weirdly kind of formal, not, it didn't feel formal. It just sounded formal. And I can see that creeping into both my writing and my speech.
Wow. If people are listening to this, sometimes if you think of someone as senior as yourself in terms of like the position you hold, like it's a quite powerful position, you know, in the New York Times, you're very high up in the echelons of art criticism, art reviewing. Can we talk about the psychology of it? Because I find it so interesting, the word dread, because you said something about dread earlier. And the introduction as well, you were talking about when you were younger and how you would have been like nervous or like, you know, being pushed into the swimming pool, you know, before you learned to swim.
With all the adults, yeah.
Yeah. Can you talk a bit about that kind of fragility of like the confidence when you approach writing? Because I feel like there's so many writers I know that you assume they like love writing and they really enjoy writing their novel or whatever, but actually it's tortuous. And even when we wrote our books, like it's a really stressful thing to have that pressure because you know people are going to read it and then judge you and look back. But I love that coming from someone who's seen, you know, respected globally as a kind of voice for art.
Well, I just think, you know, first of all, I think in the art world, you know, you find the calling that fits your neuroses. You know, I'm a procrastinator. I think that once I leave the Times, I'll never write again, you know.
Happily,
probably.
Without the deadline.
Yeah. And that I have to have people who want it now. And I'm sort of, you know, I go, whether it's every week or every other week, I go from one piece to the next. And every time you start a piece, I can't believe that I'm the only one who feels like I'm going to be discovered as a fraud. I'm going to be viewed as an idiot. You know, I can name four critics that could do this better. And it's kind of great in a way because it keeps you humble. Mm. I mean, I don't really ever think about what kind of power I have, you know, because all I know
is... You must be aware that you are one of the most important critics in the world. How do you...
In the abstract, but right. I just stay in New York. I don't go on... At least since COVID, I have not been in an airplane. And sometimes I think I might never again be in an airplane. I mean, there's certainly enough going on here. I do know that that's kind of cosseted, to say the least, and that I'm missing a lot. But I really believe in a local art scene. Mm. You have to have one before you're going to have any kind of stature anywhere else. Before that scene is going to have any stature. But writing at certain points is incredibly fun. Once something gets going and
you're in the sweet spot.
So-called flow, right, the sweet spot. But getting started, it takes me a long time to find what we call the top. You know, like I usually have about five tops going. And I can't write. Once in a while, I can jump ahead and write something. But I really have to write with a kind of structure, a progression in mind. Like, I can't just say, oh, I'll write this graph here and it'll go in later. That's not one of my habits.
So when you say the top, this is your entry into the piece.
Yeah, how do you get the viewer interested and how do you keep them interested?
Got it.
And, you know, you want to start out with a certain kind of boom. You know, it might be a little boom, but you just want to write something that as language will snag them. And then you try to keep that going. Of course, you're not going to, but, you know, if you can do it for three sentences.
Then you're in.
Then you go on.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
And being a partner of another art critic, your partner Jerry Sauls, another foremost art critic, one of the most important in the Western world, writes in the New York Magazine. Do you keep each other going? If you're a procrastinator, does he go, come on, Roberta, you've got to write this review and vice versa? And
you
is
bet.
There any competition between you two?
Well, he's not a procrastinator. His whole approach to writing is, I have to write this now and get this out of me, out of my computer, into the editor, and then get the playback and see how it goes. But he has a fantastic work ethic, and I have almost none, you know? So, but we help each other, like, you know, we help each other, say, with first lines.
Oh, wow.
But Jerry has a real talent. I mean, like, pretend Jeff Koons is an artist. Isn't that one of the greatest first lines ever? I mean, really. It's just like, who are you? Do you know?
Yeah.
I loved his headline last week, Tracy Emin is serious. I just thought it was such a, I was like, what? I just loved, you know.
Well, it's very much an American headline.
Yeah.
You wouldn't see it in Britain.
No, but it's brilliant.
You never write about the same shows, do you?
We do a little bit.
Do you?
We try to avoid it. I've been really avoiding it. You know, like, he wrote something on Charles Taylor, but he didn't see the show. He did an advance based on paintings. So some of that is unavoidable. And then I won't write on Dana Schutz, partly because I wrote on her last show. So I was, as far as I was concerned, I was out of the picture. You know,
was it a positive response?
Yeah, I mean, I think she's made great strides with each of her shows. Have you seen this show?
Yeah.
I mean, I think it was really like, okay, this is what a really good artist looks like when they become great. I mean, just like her finally stepping into a kind of maturity.
Mm.
And you can look back and you can sort of see what didn't quite work with her other amazing piles of figures and heads and things. There was much more control and clarity, and I thought.
Yeah, it was impressive. I loved that painting of the figure in the bed. It's like a smaller work, and it's almost like an alien woman alien person with kind of objects
like
on
a lipstick
head.
On her head.
Right. I just loved that painting. It was the thing that just like sucked me in.
They say this thing with artists that if you make something for 10 years, it's boring. If you do it for 20 years, you're a genius. Have you noticed that with many artists?
Yes. I mean, I think it takes a really long time for most painters to become good. And I know that there have been certain painters that I thought, well, you're not interested in that. I'm not interested in that painting. And then like 5 or 10 years later, it's like, oh, okay, here's the good part is really beginning now, you know? And I think we all forget that, you know, that most artists, you know, you can have like somebody who's incredibly precocious, like Frank Stella, you know, who's like a senior at Princeton or something, and he's already getting attention from, partly because he has a New York painter for a teacher, Stephen Green, who just goes, and then he hits some problems later on, a lot of people would say, and I was interested probably longer than most of the people I came into the art world with, you know. And Judd, you know, Judd is completely the opposite, and that's always inspirational too. You know, he took a good over a decade of making paintings he didn't really like, and finally like edging into relief and edging into three dimensions. I mean, he's very cautious, if nothing else.
Does the art world feel healthy now, or is there a period where you felt like it was really at its most kind of sexy, or do you feel like we are stagnating, or is it exciting and still inspiring at the moment?
Well, I mean, I'm in the middle of it.
Yeah.
So I'm probably not the best person to ask. I've always been excited by the art world, and I continue to be. It's much, much different. I mean, when I worked for Paula Cooper, I wasn't even writing them, but I asked for a day off. I worked 4 days a week. And the fifth day, I saw virtually all the galleries I wanted to see in New York. I'd start up at 81st Street with the Bikert Gallery, see Klaus Curtis in the late morning. And then I'd just come down Madison Avenue, across 57th Street, and down to Soho. And that was it. I mean...
So Chelsea didn't exist at that point, really?
Soho barely existed at that point. Wow. Just, you know.
So it's a lot easier to navigate back then as well. Yeah. I guess there's so many. There's hundreds now, isn't there?
There's more. And there was this huge increase after COVID. That's when it's since COVID that the art world, that the gallery scene has gotten just completely out of control. I mean, I used to be able to keep legal pad lists for each neighborhood, and I'd know what I'd seen. I know what I'd missed. And it was almost all written down. It would take 5 or 6 pages, but it was how I kept track of things. There's no way you can do that. There's no way you can know about new neighborhoods and all the galleries in them.
Does it feel like you have to know, though? Or do you feel like you have to know what's going on constantly? Or do you just know the shows that you're going to be working on now to a certain extent?
Well, I always dreaded that because I always thought if I'm just seeing the shows I'm writing about, that's really bad. That's right. A very blinkered view. But it happens sometimes. Like I can go whole months because of writing that I don't get out to galleries. That was unheard of before COVID.
Mm.
And so I try to keep up. I'm sort of at the stage where I'm not going to Brooklyn anymore. You know, I know there's interesting things going on there. But I also think that everything will come, you know, that Manhattan is a kind of magnet and art dealers are not, you know, they're always looking for new material.
So does that upset people, though, if you say that you're not going to Brooklyn anymore?
I don't say it very often.
You've just said it with talk art.
I know. Oops. And it's probably not totally true, but it has been true since COVID.
Right.
You know, but I know how to get there, so...
That hasn't changed.
I'm sure you will.
That hasn't changed.
I read a really beautiful interview with you with Jarrett Ernest. It was talking about a time when someone had been quite critical of your writing early on, and then you moved to another publication. I think maybe you moved to Art in America or
right.
But it got me thinking for some reason about Faith Ringgold when she said that her major obstacle in her career was actually being a woman, like primarily, beyond even racism and it being a black woman. It was actually this idea that, you know, being a woman is actually top of the list of like obstacles. Yeah. What was it like for you in the 70s, 80s as a woman writer? Did you experience a lot of kind of resistance, or did you just get support because it was an art world which was probably a smaller industry, I guess?
Well, I was very naive, and I'm not sure, and not too I wasn't a feminist, so I wasn't looking, I wasn't scrutinizing for that kind of an issue. So I'm sure that there's a way I went through stuff that I didn't experience as such. There are a few male critics that, you know, said things to me that I know I didn't appreciate then and I don't appreciate now.
Like what can you say?
Somebody said, well, you're a formalist. It's like, ooh.
What do they mean by that, though, that you...
They obviously, you know, that I'm just writing about what I see and, you know, what it's made of and stuff like that.
Okay.
So I'm going to say
they were saying you're more surface than what they were doing. Okay.
More object oriented.
Right.
And I think everybody has to, no matter what you end up writing about, you sort of have to start out as a formalist because the object is the evidence of the theories you're building around it, you know, and there has to be some kind of agreement. But anyway, I think I was very unconscious. I wasn't too conscious of my ambition, but I kept pushing, you know, in a certain way. And I had really close friends who I knew were very good writers, well-read, and good editors. They really helped me. You know, I'm basically a really good critic named Sanford Schwartz was sort of my writing coach for a while.
Oh, wow.
You know, and he had complete confidence in me, and he also could say, well, that's not so good. Or I'd hand him like 10 sheets of rough, and he'd be reading down. He'd say, oh, here's your beginning, you know, like into the second page or something.
There's your top.
Yeah, there's your top. So, you know, it was like something that caught his interest. You just say, you know, get rid of that or put it elsewhere.
It's a skill. Can I ask you an existential question? Why is art important?
Well, I mean, it's nourishment. It's a form of food. Why is food important? I think art has so many functions for all these different people, all different ages. It's pleasure. It's age-old wisdom. It's showing you different parts of time and different parts of the world. When you're young, it's showing you yourself, which is why I think one of the many reasons this nation is so fucked up right now has been, and maybe it's the first reason, has been the continual cutting back of education. Somebody at the art fair yesterday said, since Reagan, and I thought, oh my God, since Reagan, do you know? And it's exactly what the right wanted. They want an uninformed electorate. And I just think that the whole, that half of the nation is kind of miserable. The first thing Hayter Rhodes is the hater. If that's your chief emotion and you're spending your whole time, you know, policing, you know, in broader and broader circles the entire world, you're just being eaten inside. Mm. You know, and it has so much of what they hate has no, does not impinge on their life in any way. You know, it's just this kind of symbolic, and it's a place to which they are directed by political leaders to keep in a state, high state of dudgeon all the time. And I think art, music, dance, all of these things cut through. You know, they get to they help people discover their cores. It's like, oh yeah. I mean, there are plenty of kids who go to the theater for the first time or hear music for the first time who just know immediately that's what they want to do. And their lives have been saved. I mean, if you have that in you, it's part of your responsibility to see that you help somebody else find that in themselves. And I like to think maybe I do that with my writing, but you can't, it's not this thing. I mean, people talk about art for art's sake. I just sort of, I want to say, what is that? What is art for art's sake? Because art is made for the sake of anybody who claims it, who experiences it, finds it meaningful to experience.
I think that's, you just made me very emotional. I think yeah. If you're a creative person, you've just said that you have a responsibility to help someone else realize their creativity.
Yeah.
It's like passing on the gift of creativity. Right. And you have to do it. That's really fucking beautiful.
And it's also a tremendous, tremendously satisfying, you know, for the person passing it along.
Correct.
It's not just a favor you're doing everyone.
But it's an act of generosity, isn't it?
Yeah.
I guess your writing is an act of generosity. Yes, it's your job, but also you are
sharing.
Yeah. You're a conduit
well,
to
like
discovery.
To think that.
And that's what we try and do with the podcast.
Yeah.
We're a conduit to discovery. It's an act of generosity.
It's really funny because on the opening of Tracy's show at White Cube, we were stood on the street outside with Shirley Manson from Garbage, and a fan from Russia came up to her on the street and said, oh my God, you're Shirley. And then started telling her all these stories about what the music had done for his life as a teenager and all of this stuff, just like blurting it all out. And then he left and took a photo and left. And then somebody came up to me about talk art and started doing the same thing. And we were both laughing to each other because we were like, that's so funny. We've had two people just recognize us on the street.
Yeah.
But then I said to her, isn't it amazing though, both those people, they're not really telling us well done. They're telling us about themselves and their journey, which has been facilitated through the podcast, through her music. And she said, yes, that's the greatest lesson to learn as a, you know, pop star, as a podcaster, as whatever, that it's not about us. It's about the listener and their,
what
you know,
set off in the listener.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
And like empowering, giving
right.
them agency to discover who they are and then feel stronger. And that's such an amazing privilege.
I know, but think of all these people who just came from, who had that, found that maybe completely by accident, and it propelled them into their life. You know, there was this really good high school or maybe elementary school in Philadelphia. I forget. I think it was a public school. I can't remember. But Louis Kahn, who was a refugee from a poor area, went to the school. And he happened to have, like, very early on, a teacher who taught architecture, you know, and it's a complete fluke because architecture is not one of those subjects. But, you know, when you ask questions like that, Russell, like, what is art for? Just change it to music, because music is more accessible it's more physically accessible. I mean, it's more accessible because it's all around us. And we feel it in our bodies in a more direct way. And eventually people and artists, visual artists, I think, always feel art in their bodies. But it takes a little more conscientious effort for, well, I actually think everybody feels art in their bodies. They just don't, they just cut it off because they're more self-conscious. With music, you know what you like and you know what you don't like. And it's very... you're very certain in a certain way. I mean, you know, like, okay, listen to this record five times. You'll get, you know, like there's some hit song that you think stinks. And then you come around to seeing what a few other million people see in it.
Yeah. I always saw that because it's almost like it travels through the ether. Yeah. Whereas art was harder for people to access. And that was one of the main reasons I decided to move from music into running a gallery or working with prints, was to try and help facilitate and be the person in between the artwork and the audience.
Yeah.
To try and encourage people to get into art. And weirdly, we then started the podcast.
Yeah.
But it's like, that was obviously like a mission for a lot of us, I think.
Yeah. Elizabeth Murray tells this story about being, I don't know, in nursery school or kindergarten. She was in an art class and a teacher came along, and I don't know why, what he was teaching or she was teaching, but started to just cover a sheet of paper with red crayon. And Elizabeth just remembered watching that happen, you know, just pure color, spreading it around, you know, and I just think that's amazing. It doesn't take that much, but it does take something, and it takes some consciousness in your environment. And once there's very little consciousness of that in this country right now, that it's not this recreational thing, and that it, and even if you don't become an artist, that kind of experience will help direct you. I mean, there might be, you know, people who end up being designers or doing something, or builders who start that experience with a work of art, you know? And I think that right now in America, we can't conceive of the billions of dollars in wasted talent that we expend every year just by not educating people. Mm. And it involves the whole country. Like, I love these guys up in, what was it, Idaho or Montana, who decided they did not want, in the state legislature, they did not want to fund school lunches for poorer children. You want to say, so you don't mind having a lot of ignorant children running around the state, right? Because if you don't give them lunch, they're not going to be well prepared to learn. Mm. You know, I was just like, stuff like that makes me so furious.
Yeah.
I think we're very much aligned on all of these things.
Yeah.
Totally.
If you look back at your life and you've made this kind of commitment to writing about art and to the art world and to artists, even if you don't get to chat to them that often, we have a joke in Margate that we've got a mosque opposite the gallery, and then we also have like a Christian church, and then we have Tracy Emin studio, and we have our gallery, and that we're all literally facing each other. And we always joke that art is a religion, or art is somehow, you know, something that you can commit to and dedicate a life to. Do you feel like that was something that you did, like, you know, that kind of dedication, or did it have that kind of passion for you?
Yeah, well, I think that I became kind of conscious of the idea of quality even before art. Like I say that my first aesthetic experience was getting into my aunt's Mercedes. She was a real estate dealer up in Westchester. Getting into that car and suddenly realizing, like, this is not a Buick, you know, not a Plymouth, which is what I'd, you know, just understanding that there's some things that are really, really great in their own right. And I'm interested in a wider definition of art. But yes, I'm very dedicated to the visual. And I'm very dedicated to the idea, which is probably unsolvable by now in this country, but of visual literacy. Not only personal, but social as well. I mean, we have so many ugly buildings in this country. And if you think that they're not affecting the way people develop and think, and the standards they set for themselves, you're crazy. Mm. It's like illness. And I don't think you have it that way in Europe, because you've been there longer.
We're not part of Europe anymore, sadly.
That's but yes. True.
Well, we're part of...
I believe in my heart we are.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. And location-wise, we still are.
Right.
But yeah, it's tragic.
And age-wise, you still are.
Yeah.
So you have
But you're
have
right.
Physical...
There's also a lot of protection of like history, and you can't just knock down old buildings or stuff right. like that. And we have a lot of free museums, which I know is something that's a passion of yours,
yeah.
hoping to try and get museums free.
Yeah, well, that's not after the summer in which all the major New York museums went to $30 a visit.
Yeah, put the prices
up. I like
up.
To think, well, maybe it'll encourage a lot of people to become members, you know, but... That's really hard. You sit there and you calculate how many visits you're going to make a year, all that. But I think Europe has it. Just age and just the fact that you are a series of cultures who had to start building way before the industrial age, and that things couldn't be made cheaply. They had to be solid. They had to be made out of rocks or whatever. And that there's a whole kind of internal knowledge or language of understanding of good materials and of, and I don't know what else there is. I don't know if towns are zoned in Britain or if you just have people who build developments that look a lot better than they do here. But there's a kind of, and it probably drives true architects crazy, but there's a kind of pleasant homogeneity in certain, you know, particularly older neighborhoods. Mm. But I remember, like, when you land at Heathrow, you just go away, all these neighborhoods where they're just all, the houses are all really close together, if not attached. And there's this wonderful continuity of, like, red tile roofs and, you know, and it gives a feeling of community where there may not be one, but it certainly also encourages it.
Mm. Yeah, through the visual, yeah.
Well, let's get on to our final questions. This has been incredible, Roberta. Thank you so much for letting us into your home and letting us talk to you for this long.
Not at all.
The first question is, if you could do an art heist, if you could have any work of art in the world for yourself, what would it be and why? If you can't have you can have a bootleg version of it, which we have here with the Weeping Woman by Picasso, but if there was an original, would it be the Picasso?
It would probably be the Picasso, I'm afraid.
Why that painting in particular?
Because it just is so aggressive in its colors and its form and its emotion. And I know that it's a very problematic painting from a feminist point of view. This is a woman who's hysterical. I think it's Dora Maar, but I just love that painting. And there are all kinds of things I would have, like certain works of folk art, outsider art, like a Horace Pippin. Probably most of them would be paintings, or there might be a Rosie Lee Tompkins quilt, who's this amazing quilter, who was really not well known until 20 years ago.
So would you visit outside of work? Is it the Folk Art Museum, for example? Is that somewhere you'd visit for pleasure outside of work?
Yeah. I mean, the embarrassing thing is that I visit almost nothing for pleasure. I do see a lot of shows. Sometimes I go and I look at a show and I look at it and look at it. And I'm out and I think, I don't really know shows if I haven't written about them. That there's a certain way I get to know an exhibition that is not available to me without note-taking, checklist, pressure of a deadline. And that can be very limited. So, I mean, there are times when, like, you're in Europe and you go and see. You go to Rimini and you run into a church for 5 minutes before it closes for lunch. And you sort of get mosaics. You know, I've had some really awful, stupid experiences, like poorly planned experiences, shall we say. But a folk art museum is I find that art unusually direct and full of talent. Mm-hmm. And so that's some place where I'm almost guaranteed. I mean, they don't have a lot of art in their current shrunken state. But I don't know, I like art. I like all kinds of art, but I like art that's portable. I really like the art that, you know, people can take home and put on their walls and live with, and not people who are not billionaire collectors who basically recreate museums on the scale of museums. I mean, most art today is so big. And I guess Dana Schutz has to make paintings those size. And one of the reasons you like that painting of the woman with the bald head in bed, it's like a tenth the size of all the other paintings. You could actually put it in a shopping bag and take it home.
Yeah.
Do you know?
That's so true.
Or, you know, almost. I can't quite remember the exact.
There's also something about trauma and sickness and illness or something, or recovery or something about that work that I think spoke to me, you know, as a Frida Kahlo fan or something.
Exactly.
It's like I'm always drawn to works that are like
harrowing.
What is that one again? The one on
Alice Neal.
That's an early, very early, like 1933 Alice Neal.
So that's another replica?
Yeah.
Bootleg.
And they're actually painted by the same artist.
But you also love that image?
Yes.
And what was it about the Alice Neal?
It's just really good painting.
Yeah.
Do you know, I mean, it just has, I mean, painting, it seems so easy to look at. And you can tell, like, yeah, that has real impact. And that artist doesn't even have an idea of impact, at least on me. Do you know? It's the most thing like music, where you see it and you know it. Or drawings, of course. There's some sculptors now who are making really great things. But
like who?
Well, I can only think, like yesterday at the art fair, I spent like half an hour talking to an artist named Anne Agee, who's a ceramic artist, whose work, I missed her last show, so I might not have gotten a sense of the transition, but who's gone from making small kind of tchotchke referential things to these almost life-size clay figures, which are Madonnas with children, except that the children are female. And then they're decorated with colors and fabric patterns in different ways. And she was just telling me how she does this and why they look so weird, which is that she makes them flat. And then she makes kind of a lot of crosshatch seams at the edges. So the sculptures end up with seams, and that's how they're three-dimensional. They're fully three-dimensional in the end. I don't know. I was just really taken aback by that. And there's like Alvaro Barrington is a good young painter who's become known very quickly. And another artist named Jameson Green, who shows it. Derek Eller, the Henry Taylor Show. I mean, there are a lot of Black artists that are good because they're very free. And they also have a subject that is kind of genetic, which is the legacy of slavery and of being Black in this country. They have, I mean, I've said it before, but there, when the German neo-expressionists first came up, you realize that the difference between German neo-expressionists and American was that the Germans really had, the young Germans were really coming out from under something, which was the role of their country in World War II. And that gave them a certain kind of credibility or solidity or something that you could sense in the work. That wasn't the way it was here.
You know, it's just reminding me of a question I wanted to ask you, which was, I remember when you reviewed Catherine Bernhardt, who I worked with for a long time, and I was actually really surprised when I saw your review, and I think it was of the E.T. show, maybe, when she did all the E.T. works, or one of the, it was that era. But I then went back and saw that you'd reviewed her earlier, and that you'd been very supportive of her work. And I don't know why it surprised me, but I was like, that's so cool that, like, Roberta's into it. Because the aesthetic of a lot of the people you champion is so different every time. So what is it you're looking for when you think someone's authentic or someone's, you know, worth writing about because you believe in what they're doing? Because it's obviously not just one thing, which I find so fascinating.
Well, I think I'm always looking for a kind of visual jolt, a kind of coherence and something that, you know, something you can't look away from. And I don't think that is measured in styles. Do you know that there are lots of different ways for this to be achieved? That's what I find so weird about any kind of ideological point of view, although I'm sure I have an ideology as well, but, you know, where you're really strict and just like saying, you know, if you're saying that, you don't really know your own taste. You don't know how completely promiscuous your taste is, and that you're going to, you know, at some point, something's going to make you aware of that. And then you're going to spend the rest of your life realizing there's more and more art that you like, and you're never going to get to the bottom of it because there's too much art for any one person to retain. So, no, and I think also I was put off by her work, and I think Jerry liked it, so that I hung around with it and looked at it more. I mean, there are plenty of things that I dismissed prematurely. and that you regret later. And you
like us all, though. I think we all do that.
Well, that's what I mean by taste. If you let your taste, like one thing I say is don't be afraid to let your taste betray you. I mean, you're going to find yourself liking, being embarrassed to like some of the things you like.
So true.
And
give yourself permission.
Yeah. You give yourself permission.
I've also found some of the things that repelled me early on are the things that now are my
exactly
favorite ever works.
So yeah. Funny,
or
it?
Things that just didn't convince me on any level and I completely wrote off end up having the most meaning.
Yeah.
I feel like that with Francis Bacon, it always used to scare me. So I sort of avoided it to a certain extent. And then the last few years, it's become one of the most important
really
kind of artists and what he's doing and the story and his narrative and everything.
Yeah.
That's changed my life.
Yeah. Absolutely.
But it was always peripheral before.
I had it with Rebecca Warren as well, because early on I just didn't understand what it was. And I was like, what is this work? It was like some sort of alien landing in a gallery. Or
right,
something.
Right.
And now it's like she's my favourite sculptor.
Yeah, same.
And she's also so sort of rigorous in how she presents herself to the world. So she's not probably as well known right now globally as a lot of other artists are in her generation. Mm-hmm. But I still feel like she's one of the most important. And long term, I think her work will really stand up. You know, when we're all dead and gone, I think her work will just keep on. There's a mystery within it and some curious world within it that I've not seen anywhere else. And I think that's why when I first ever saw it, I was so confused.
Yeah.
Whereas now I feel like passionate about it, like in my soul.
It's always like if you really hate something, it's always a good idea to spend a little more time with it.
Completely agree.
That's, you're having a real reaction. Mm. It's not, you're not indifferent to it. And it's very, you know, it's possible that that's touching something in you and you're just going to be uncomfortable and then you're going to get comfortable.
Yeah, because people like to feel comfortable. They like what they know.
Yeah.
So to be shocked or shaken out of what you know is actually where you're going to grow. And
I've tried it a lot. I can't stand Richter's squeegee paintings. They make me so angry. And every time I see one, I stand in front of it and I'm like, I fucking hate this. Why do I hate it so much? And I still haven't solved it, Roberta. I'm trying. For you, I'll keep going. The second question we ask is, what's your favourite colour?
Red.
Why red?
Because it just is so powerful. And it's, you know, can make almost any painting better.
There you go, Lego artists listening, if you want a good
also,
review.
Also, holding your double gulp
coffee,
which is also in red, the logo. Yeah. I didn't realize you both did double gulps. I always thought that was a Jerry thing, but is it a couple thing?
I end up often doing what he does. You know, it's very much a kind of follow the leader situation, particularly in domestic issues. He has a very, like, see these empty shelves all around here? Mm. When we built these and moved in, and he was putting the books away, and I said, well, what's that? You know, why aren't you putting books in those shelves? And he said, well, I'm going to be putting objects in there. It was like, you know, he curates things. I would never have done that. And that would be so horrible if it were a solid wall of books.
Yeah, it would feel more intense, wouldn't it? More oppressive somehow. Yeah. Also probably more dread for when you're writing. It's like, look at all these books.
Were you writing when you both met? Were you both like writers art in the art world?
No, he wasn't a writer, which was in the beginning was quite an issue with me.
Because you were determined to be with a writer? Or?
Well, no, because I thought I was sort of the main thing in the relationship. You know, and I said to him, look, if I'd wanted to be with a critic, I would have, you know. And it seemed like the worst idea. And I did a couple of awful things to deter him.
Like what?
Well, I remember Jerry went to Italy. It's like he had to leave the country just as the Village Voice was trying to get him. And I remember he called and I was like standing outside the UN building looking at Long Island City. And I was saying, you just can't do this. You know, it's just going to screw everything up. You really can't. You're not up for it. You're not ready for it. Blah, blah, blah. I can be intensely unsupportive. And
honest, maybe.
He said, well, he was with Francesco Bonomi. And he said, well, Francesco says I have to do it. And I just said, okay.
And this was a role that you had there, then he had the same role.
Right. Well, there were several years in between. I forget when he went there. He went sometimes in the 90s, and I left in about 86.
So there was slight competitiveness at the beginning with you guys then.
Yeah, that's what I said. That's why I liked Lawrence. It wasn't really competitive. I mean, if I've been around in high school with all these girls who were like wearing versions of the latest thing in New York City. It would like, I probably would have killed myself, you know?
I feel like every time we've spoken to Jerry, he always makes the point that you are the main thing, though. He's like, if you think I'm good, wait till you meet Roberta.
No, we're just different, you know? And he has, I mean, to watch Jerry look at somebody's work and then just tell them what they should be doing, and knowing that it's something that makes them very uncomfortable to hear. And they'll probably come back to him, you know, in a year's time and interrupt another conversation he's having with someone else and say, you know, you were totally right. I don't often have that kind of instinctive. He has a great trust of his instincts. Like, he took pictures of himself kneeling and praying in front of Tracy Emin's paintings. And I said, do you have to do that?
No. You'd never do that.
I thought about that as well, because it's, we just interviewed Marina Abramovich, and she has such a way of being photographed and using hands and using body shapes that go international. It's kind of like something beyond words, you know, I'm really struck with that, with the way Jerry presents himself.
Photographs pointing at people.
Totally, exactly. The kind of expressive gesture and the power of the gesture. And Ai Weiwei does it a lot too.
Yeah.
And actually Tracy does it in her own way. Like, certain people have that way of visual language and communication.
Yeah, and it's a kind of style because they always do it.
But it works. It really reaches people. It's really
interesting.
Connects,
yeah.
Yeah, no, he just started doing that when there started being, I mean, there wasn't so much photography before.
Hmm.
Anyway, he has a lot to say about that. And then we both go our own ways. Sometimes one of us will beat the other up and say, you have to write about this. You know, what you said to me is really good, blah, 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 blah. You have a reaction, go with it. But other than that.
He's listening in the other room, I'm sure, right now. Jerry, you listening?
I'm going to have a sip of her coffee. Hello, everybody. Hello.
So do you have any other vices apart from coffee?
Oh,
Like snacks? Are there things you eat when you write?
I tend not to eat when I... Well, sometimes I do, but... Well, we were talking about sugar the other night.
We were, because I'd given it up.
And I ate dessert and you didn't.
That's right. You know? And I kept pushing the next dessert onto you, and you kept pushing it away. It was very common.
Kept passing them to Lindsay. We've gotten pretty good about not bringing things into the house, because we're both mild foodaholics, and there are certain things that if they're in the house, Roberta will eat them.
That's what
Roberta
I'm like.
Will make sure that there aren't any left,
yeah,
you know, like, because that's when the house becomes safe, when those things aren't there.
But
also, you keep, if you're on Instagram, everything you thought was a snack gets denounced as like Kind bars. I thought Kind bars were the answer, and now Instagram says they're really bad.
You know? Can't ever win.
That's really Can't funny, allegedly.
What is the best advice you've ever received when it comes to your work?
I don't think I've ever received, I mean, except from Sanford Schwartz, who would just say, this is good. And then he wouldn't say anything about any other thing. You know, well, and also you get advice from reading. Like, I got advice from reading, especially Pauline Kael and Edmund Wilson. Pauline Kael was this great film critic for The New Yorker. Mm. Very fabulous writer. I mean, so stylized, you couldn't believe it, but also very personal. And then Edmund Wilson is this great literary critic, American, who really was a force for at least 40 or 50 years. He reviewed for The New Yorker for a number of years. But these were people who, like, Wilson's writing was so clear and simple, you know. And the same, well, Kael's was more ornate and kind of had more personality. So in a way, they were very complimentary for me.
Right.
You know, or like, I sometimes say to people, like, just read the first chapter of Jane Jacobs, The Fall and Rise of the Great American City, or Rise and Fall, like, where she just kind of, you know, grabs you by the neck and you stay with her until you don't. But she basically lays out her whole theory of people and architecture.
Well, we've stayed with you for the last hour and a half, I think it is. Well, so thank you so much. I just want to end on one of your quotes that you say that your main responsibility is getting people out of the house. And I think that is what your work does for so many people, that we read your reviews and we want to get out of the house and see as much art as we can. So thank you so much for that.
Not at all.
This has been a big moment for us. Thank you so much, Roberta Smith.
Likewise. Thank you guys.
You're on Instagram, aren't you?
I am.
What's the handle? Is it at Roberta Smith?
I think it's Roberta Smith NYT.
NYT.
New York Times.
Oh, yeah, New York Times. I thought it was NYC, but it's NYT.
Well, I keep hoping when I retire that I can get NYC.
You can edit it.
I've seen somebody else at the Times do that, but you never know.
And then there's links from your Instagram. Go to the reviews or the...
I don't have a tree yet. I should get that. So anything I link...
A link tree. Yeah, you should.
Because I only have the most recent thing.
Or you can just get
be
a
amazing
subscription
if you had one that went all the way back. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that would really be scary.
Terrifying.
Jesus.
For everyone listening, we're going to post pictures of the things we talked about today. And this has been brilliant. Thank you so much again, Roberta, and we'll see you all very soon.
We'll be back soon. Thanks for listening.
Bye, Roberta.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.